Welcome to the Seattle Public Library's podcasts of author readings and library events, a series of readings, performances, lectures, and discussions. Library podcasts are brought to you by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation. To learn more about our programs and podcasts, visit our website at www.spl.org. To learn how you can help the Library Foundation support the Seattle Public Library, go to foundation.spl.org. The podcast you are about to hear was recorded in 2010. Welcome to the Central Library, and thank you all so much for joining us for this evening with Sarah Gruen. I had the pleasure of hearing Sarah speak at Book Expo America in the spring. I put aside what I was reading and delved right into Ape House, and I finished it before we even left town. It's just wonderful. So first, thank you to Elliott Bay Book Company for inviting us to host this event, to the Seattle Times for generous promotional support for library programs, to Real Networks Foundation for sponsoring our author series. I'm going to now just turn things over to Rick Simonson from the Elliott Bay Book Company. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Chris, and thank all of you for being here tonight. This is a great and amazing response to see you all here. 4 years ago, though it was not her first book, a novel published by this little publisher down in North Carolina called Algonquin took on the publication of a novel that soon most of the people in this room probably would come to know as Water for Elephants. A book that totally captivated people, a book set in sort of circus, in and around a circus in the early 1930s. And one of those books that truly has kept going, it's never stopped. And when Sarah, even though there was a great response that first year, this wouldn't have been the response quite on this level. But it's a book that very much, has continued. And one of the things that came out of that book was, you know, the relationship between human beings and another species. In that case, although circus had other animals, you know, there was a particularly memorable elephant. Tonight, what happened with that book is so remarkable that one is both gets excited and there's sometimes a little trepidation about what's going to happen with the next book, because what happens with a book like Water for Elephants can't always be repeated or built upon in terms of what happens, either both the response or even the work itself. I wouldn't go into particulars here, but I can certainly think of several times where what happened after this one marvelous book wasn't followed up with. And as Chris even alluded to, hearing Sarah talk about the book and read from a little bit several months ago, Ape House is a book that is doing, I think, and will do everything that happened with Water for Elephants and more. It's an amazing and marvelous book. Not that she's left elephants behind. In fact, not to go into a long thing, but there's a great photograph recently online of Sarah being hoisted by the trunk of an elephant. It was one of these, like, what was that? Really little book things we get online. And so there's somebody in the air with an elephant, you know, lifting her up. But in this book, the focus shifts, and human beings have their part to play in this book, but it's memorably charactered by a group of bonobo apes that are in this research center in the Midwest. And the book tells a story of what happens with people and with the apes, and very much becomes of one of what's learned and observed between the apes themselves, who have names, who are very much characters in this book. And then occasionally the human mess gets in there too. People's romances, things of this nature about what ensues. And I think one of the things that Sarah Gruen's, it's a knack, a gift, and it's a very developed one, is not only this need to understand other beings besides our human selves, but in really looking closely and getting to know them, that's a way for us to actually also pay attention to ourselves and knowing our own place in the world. She does this marvelously in this book. And so tonight, as part of this, the busy whirlwind of going around the country, she is here starting a week that takes her down the West Coast. Tonight, she will read briefly. She'll talk about this book. I mean, it's also, as many of you probably have seen, it's got all sorts of conversations going on about apes and their there's parts of their use of language, their relationship to each other, their understanding of many more things than earlier versions of science would have had them know. But she'll talk about the book and then take some questions. And then following that, she'll be at this table here to sign copies of the book. A couple of things, because of the level and size of the tour and also just the audience, she's not going to be able to personalize personal inscriptions, but she will sign and you get to visit with her. With that, we at Elliott Bay thank the library and the Library Foundation once again, and now thank all of you, and ask you now please join in welcoming the marvelous and wonderful writer, Sarah Gruen.
Wow. Wow, this is great. Thank you for inviting me here. I just had a tour of this really spectacular library, and I can't wait to see what it looks like from the outside because I didn't stop to notice on the way in. I also want to say especially thank you for supporting your local independent bookseller, and thank you to the Library Foundation for what, really, truly, this is the most spectacular library I've ever seen. I'm going to talk a little bit about, I'll call a spade a spade. I'm going to ramble a little bit about my research, and then I'm going to do a very short reading because nobody comes to hear authors read. And then I'm going to open the floor to question and answer, which is my favorite part, because people have lots of questions about these books. And so I got the idea for this book about 4 years ago when I was about to go on tour for Water for Elephants, or I may have actually already been on tour. Anyway, I was not at a point where I could start writing, but my mother sent me an email that contained a link to the website of the Great Ape Trust in Des Moines, Iowa. And I went to the website, and I was doubly fascinated by the language research that was being done there with apes, the first reason being that I have been following very closely the story of Coco the gorilla, who is a language-competent ape who uses a version of American Sign Language called Gorilla Sign Language because it's adapted to accommodate the shape of her thumb. I've been following Coco since 1980, which kind of dates me. But the second reason I was fascinated was that I'd never heard of bonobo apes. And they're really, really fascinating. They're the most recently discovered of the Great Ape Trust the Great Ape species. They used to be thought of as simply a subspecies of chimpanzee, but there are, and they look fairly similar, there are subtle differences. Bonobos have black hair that's parted straight down the center. That's what they're born with. That's what they stay with. They have longer, slimmer limbs than chimpanzees, and so they kind of look like the ballet dancers of the ape world. And their culture, and I use that word very carefully, is unique. They're matriarchal, egalitarian, peaceful, and very, very amorous. The average bonobo initiates some kind of sexual contact every hour and a half. And it doesn't matter with whom, every combination, every conceivable, I'll just leave it at, they're very virtuosic. And so with this combination of things going on, I decided that I had to do my next novel on this. And so many people want to go see these apes. I wrote to the trust and I said, can I please come see your apes? I really, really want to come see your apes. And apparently lots and lots and lots of people want to come see their apes. And these are not zoo exhibits. These are not animals on display. This is their home. And so they sent me a list of 18 books and scientific journals and possibly more than that, it's give or take, but I had to read a whole body of work about the 40 years in language acquisition research done with great apes. And then I went to York University and spent a few days with the linguists there who are looking at the data that the trust has collected. And I never, ever thought I would use the words linguistics and fun in the same sentence. but it was a blast. And when I left their offices, I mean, I was looking at data that actually listening to recordings of the bonobos trying to utter human English words. Their vocal tracts do not allow them to converse like that, but there are some things you can recognize in these recordings, such as egg, bring water, yes, and now apparently Sarah. So when I left their offices, I went to the bus stop. What I really wanted to do was go to the enrollment office and start over and do this as a career path. But so I wrote to the trust and said, okay, I've done my research, can I come? And I flew to Des Moines. And even though I was allowed into the trust, that didn't necessarily mean I was going to get to meet the apes, because that's up to the apes. And so, like the character in my book, I knew this and I stacked my odds as best I could ahead of time. And so I researched their likes, favorite toys, favorite foods, and bought backpacks for each of them and stuffed them full of anything and everything I could think of that an ape might find fun. Mr. Potato Head, Slinkies, Rubik's Cubes, most importantly M&Ms, bouncy balls, blankets, and so I sent an email to the trust and said, please tell the apes I'm bringing surprises. So after I had my human orientation, and they said, well, did you know such and such? Yeah, I read the books. Okay, can I see the apes? And so they went back and asked the apes, and they came back and said, not only are the apes allowing you in, they're insisting. And so I went back, and the first ape I met was Kanzi, and if you know about the trust at all, then he's probably the one you've heard on. Kanzi is a rock star, and he knows it. And by rock star, I mean actually a rock star. He's recorded with Paul McCartney and Peter Gabriel. So he's very gregarious and very sure of his own charms, and he came out and he was displaying and swaggering and sliding into walls and, you know, being big, big macho ape, and very eager to show off, played music for me, used his keyboard. And the difference with the apes in my novel and the apes at the actual Great Ape Trust is that the apes at the trust do not use ASL. They use a series of lexigrams, which are pictorial representations of words, and they have, I think, 384 symbols on their lexigram boards. And when you're in the building with them, as opposed to outside, when you're in the building with them, it's a touch screen, and they press the lexigram, and a synthesized human voice says the word over top. If you're actually outside the building with them and walking around, they carry laminated lexigram boards around under their arms. But for the purposes of my book, I needed to have their language tools literally on hand, because these apes are removed from their homes, from their home, quite forcefully. And there is a 40-year body of work with studying apes with ASL, so it was not a huge stretch. But Kanzi was talking on his keyboard, and then I met his sister, Pambanisha, and she is arguably the more language competent of the two, but she's shy, and she's quiet, and she waits until she figures out who you are and if she likes you before she'll talk to you. And so I had, like I said, done my research. I knew Pambanisha liked dogs. In fact, she has two, Samson and Delilah, and that she does not like cats, that she has sons and I have children. And so I was thinking, what can I bring as a conversational icebreaker with apes? And so I brought a picture of my dogs and I brought a picture of my kids. And I held up my, Pambanisha was watching me very steadily. Are you okay? And I held up the picture of my dogs and nothing. And so then I held up a picture of my kids, and they were much younger, and they were all in a bubble bath together. And she looked at it, and she went to her computer and typed, babies washing bubbles. And that was my first conversation with an ape. And what I didn't realize at the time, and of course should have, is that because they're matriarchal, being a mother gave me instant status. So I should have started with the kids, not the dogs. It's been an amazing kind of trip learning about these apes and also getting to know these apes. The second time I went, Well, actually, I'm going to back up just a little bit. Like I said, I ramble. But the day after I left the first time, Pam Benicia asked the scientists, "Where's Sarah? Build her nest. When's she coming back?" So naturally, I sent them a Fruit of the Month Club because I wanted to keep the invitation open. And I actually was underestimating them because they would have remembered me anyway, and more on that later. But the second time I went, Pam Benicia knew that the book was being dedicated to her, and so she was being the rock star for the day. And we came, and there was a film crew with me, and I was getting my makeup done out back, and Pam Benicia heard that I was getting my makeup done and wanted hers done. So the makeup girl very gamely gathered her kit and her stool and climbed over the barriers, and Pam Benicia and I got our makeup done together. She's got a black face, and she wore white powder on her cheeks, and she wore bright purple lipstick. She chose her own colors. She painted a little bit on her arms where she thought it was necessary. And then I discovered that she was inviting me to a tea party, and I was taken out back to wait while this got ready. And it took a while, and I didn't understand until later what exactly had happened, but people set up the blankets and the plates and so on, and Pam Benicia got upset because she wanted to set it up, so they had to take the whole thing down and let her do it. And then she brewed the tea. Pam Benicia has a kitchen. She works a gas range and she makes ramen noodles. So she brewed Earl Grey for me and Blackberry for herself. And she knew, and I have to preface this by saying that the bonobos had been declared overweight. And so they were on diets on Tuesdays and Thursdays. And this was a Tuesday, so keep that in mind. So we got out there, and she'd been saving her cookies for a week because she knew I was coming. And she'd set everything out. We had fine bone china. We poured our tea. We had the lexigram board out there, the laminated one, and the scientists were there to help me interpret because this lexigram board is really complicated. I tried to learn it ahead of time, but if you want to go and check it out, there's a version of it on the Great Ape Trust's website. I'm not sure if it's on the top level, but you can certainly find it. And it's interactive, and it's really will show you what I was up against. I really, you know, until I was there and actually using the board with the apes, I didn't have a hope. It was only through using it that I was able to learn my way around it at all. But so we're sitting there, and Pam Benicia asks if I want some milk for my tea. I said yes. And I poured my milk, and I gave it back. And she went, completely drained it. And then she told me which cookies I should eat in what order, and which ones I should dip in tea. And so I ate the three, and one of them was, I don't even have a word for it, but like vanilla wafers, two vanilla wafers that were stuffed with icing. And because she did not have a word for that on her lexigram board, she made a combination. She was calling it bread surprise. And so she told me to eat my bread surprise dipped in tea. And then she asked me if I was done with my cookies. I said, sure. I gave her the cookies, and she went, completely ate all the cookies. And then I think she felt bad about my cookie-less state, so she disappeared off into the forest for a bit and came back with a branch of specially picked leaves for me. And I watched one of the scientists eat a leaf and really, really hoped they weren't faking it and that this was poisonous, because I sat there and politely ate my brows. Really would have been improved with olive oil. Then Pam Benicia asked me if I'd had a hard-boiled egg for breakfast. I said, no. And then she told me that the bunny had recently hidden eggs in the forest. And then she looked pensive. And she added, I wish the bunny would come back. There's a guy in the background on a walkie-talkie. 5 minutes later, the Easter bunny traipses out of the trust and hides the eggs in the forest. This is Pam Benicia really milking the whole Diet Tuesday special occasion. and the crazy thing is that there's even, though I'd read about this and I'd known about this, you know, emotionally and mentally and even through reading all of the texts, there's absolutely nothing that can prepare you for the experience of conversing with an ape who segues from asking you what you had for breakfast to requesting the return of the Easter Bunny. And That same day, I had an off-site interview afterward. That was supposed to be the end of my visit. And at the interview, the scientists were there with me. We got a phone call, and one of the apes, Elikia, who at the time I did not know was pregnant, this becomes more important now, they got a phone call saying that the other apes had felt that Pampanisha had had too much time with me, and I hadn't said goodbye properly, so Elikia was refusing to eat until I went back. And so they were taking this very seriously because she was pregnant, and so they said, so what time is your flight tomorrow? And I don't do mornings at all, but for the bonobos, I'll do mornings. So I got up early the next morning, and I ordered 6 green apples from room service, and I stopped by Starbucks and got them all coffees, and went and explained to each ape. I took them an apple and a coffee each, and I went separately to each ape and explained that I had to go, and I had to go home to my own nest and my own family, and that I would be back to visit them, not soon, later, but I would be back. And one of the adolescent males there was very concerned about whether my nest was soft, if I had a good nest. And when I got to Pampanisha, she took a bite of her apple and then tried to pass me the rest of it. And because of various USDA laws, I'm not allowed to take or taste any, touch anything that she's bitten or held. But she was not going to eat her apple until I had one, so someone got me an apple from the kitchen. And then she noticed I didn't have a coffee, and she didn't want to have her coffee unless I had a coffee, and so I had to tell a little white lie and say that I'd actually had my coffee already and that I could only have one coffee a day. I don't actually drink coffee, really. But the truth of it was that I'd only brought enough coffee for the apes. Pampanisha accepted this, and that last time, she asked me, you know, when I was told her I was going home to my family, and she asked me if I would bring my own family back next time. And wow, that's really cool for my kids. But for that visit, we just lay back on blankets and ate our apples together, and we actually weren't conversing at that moment, and it was a really beautiful moment. It was one of those times when you're just sitting with a friend, and there really is no need to fill the silence. You don't have to say anything. But I did take her up on her invitation, and it was 15 days ago, I think. I'm on tour, my brain's mush. But very recently, my whole family went back, and we had a blast. We were playing tickle chase and so on with Kanzi, and my kids, 2 of my kids are taller than me. And so Kanzi didn't quite understand that they were my family at first, and so he likes to make people chase each other in front of him. Instead of actually chasing you, he likes to say, "You chase you." It's kind of like ape Baywatch or something. He likes to. So he had my youngest kid, and we were chasing each other, and he called us both over for a kiss. And he held his face up, and I kissed him, and my youngest held his face up, and Kanzi kissed him. And then my second child, who's bigger than me, tickle chased and caught me, and Kanzi, I could tell that Kanzi didn't like that. And so he called him over to the glass. He called me over again for a kiss, and he kissed me. Then he called my son over to the glass, and he held his face up, and then when my son went in for the kiss, Kanzi went to the glass and slapped the glass. I said, no, Kanzi, this is my baby. I know he's bigger than me, but this is actually my son. And so I was explaining to him that these are my children. I know 2 of them are bigger than me, but these are my children. And then I had to explain my husband. There is no concept of husband in bonobo. So I was saying, and this is my special friend with benefits. And then my kids were like, "Oh God, Mom!" And as we were saying goodbye that day, and this is why I was underestimating them when I sent them the fruit of the month, although I would never deny them their Sarah's special fruit day. But when I was leaving that day, Pampanisha asked if the next time I visited, I would bring her another Mr. Potato Head. I had not mentioned a potato head to her in 3 years. And she remembered that it was me, who brought it. And I think that really says about, that's just, well, to me, that was astonishing, even though I've known these apes for 3 years now. So I'll set up the book a little bit, then I'll do a very short reading, because like I said, I know people hate just listening to people read, it's boring. And then I'll open the floor to questions, which, as I said, is my favorite part. The family of bonobos in this book is based not very loosely on the real family of bonobos that I have been visiting at the Trust. It also follows the story of the two main characters, who one of whom is a journalist and is suffering from the downsizing that is going on in legitimate media, and suffers humiliation after humiliation until he finds himself in LA working for the worst of the glossy tabloids, I think his editor says to him at one point that it's like the National Enquirer, only glossier and with fewer alien babies. And the other one is the caretaker and researcher of the bonobos, who considers them her family. And at the beginning of the book, an explosion rocks their world, and the apes go missing for several months. I don't want to give away any spoilers, so I'm just going to say that this is at the point where the apes are still missing. Bonzi crouched in a dark corner with Lola clinging to her chest. She was the first to hear the jingling of keys and screeched a warning to the rest of her family. The men were back. The fluorescent lights flickered spasmodically and finally buzzed to life. In the cage opposite Bonzi and Lola, Sam screamed and sprinted around the small confines of his cell. He stopped to sign, "Bad visitor, bad visitor," then leapt onto the front of his extruded metal cage and shook it violently with hands and feet. When he jumped backward, his right thumb was bleeding. Oblivious to the wound, he perched near the front of his cage, his hair bristled, head cocked, on full alert. The other bonobos sat waiting, watching. Human footsteps followed, heavy-soled steps that echoed in the concrete hallway. As they approached, panic flooded Bonzi's body. She could never see them until they were immediately outside her space. Jelani, Sam, and McKenna were in cages across the aisle from Bonzi's, so she could see all of them and they could see her. But they could not see each other because the walls between them were concrete. Nobody could see Mbango, but they knew he was there. He was the only member of the family out of sight of all the others, and the strain of this situation was clear in his vocalizations. The clomping got louder until the men came into sight. There were two this time. Bonzi recognized only one. He was the food giver, coming through the halls twice a day to slide trays of tasteless, homogeneous pellets through the slots in their cages and refill their water with a hose. He never made eye contact. He never spoke to them, but was always in deep, angry conversation with some invisible other. The second man was new. He had light hair, gray eyes, and a crooked, joyless smile. "These look like chimps," he said. "You're the one who wanted them," the food man said. The stranger turned his gaze upon him. "Just saying," said the food man, lowering his eyes. "We could have got chimps a lot cheaper." The alpha male, having asserted himself, stood with hands on hips and did what Bonzi could not. He moved his eyes across her family members and evaluated them. "Are they eating and whatnot?" he said. "They appear to be." "Pears," signed Bonzi. "Good pears. Bring pears." "Because I want them to look healthy. They can't appear to be mistreated." The alpha male crouched down outside Bonzi's cage and looked her straight in the eyes. "Which one is this? Is this the matriarch?" "Me, Bonzi. Bonzi, me," she signed. "Give me pears. Eggs. Good eggs. Sam hurt." "What the hell is that? Is that some kind of monkey voodoo?" "It's creeping me out," said the food man, averting his eyes. Bonzi held the alpha male's gaze and raised her left hand in a fist, which she flicked off her ear. Then she bounced her pointed index fingers off each other in front of her chest. "Shut up, Ray. She's trying to tell us something." "Sam hurt," repeated Bonzi more urgently. "Sam hurt. Need good pears." "What the hell is she doing?" said the non-dominant. The alpha continued to watch Bonzi, who repeated her assertions in ever more urgent motions. "She's saying something." "What?" "I don't know." "Bonzi, out! Key! Gimme! Hurry! You!" The non-dominant's voice rose. "I don't like it. it's not right. Are these things even natural? Are they genetically engineered or something? Anyway, aren't they supposed to have sex all the time? They haven't done it once since they got here. They're caged separately, you imbecile. The food man shifted from foot to foot, looking uncomfortably up and down the hall. But you wait, said the Alpha. This is going to revolutionize everything. He leaned closer to the cage. Are you my girl? He whispered. Bonzi, whose response for no was simply not to respond, remained still. You're my girl, aren't you? He repeated. His voice was a hiss of rank breath between his teeth. Bonzi stayed motionless. I'm going to move you soon. He rose and addressed the other man. Come on, let's go. On his way past, he double-whacked the front of Sam's cage with an open palm. The clash reverberated through the cement hall, and Sam shrank into a corner. And that's your sneak preview.
Thank you. Thank you. And now I would love to take questions, and don't be shy because I will run like a scared bunny. Yes.
What would I consider to be the thematic statement for Water for Elephants? What constitutes family? Is it what we're born into? Is it what we create? How we treat each other? How we treat various segments of society? How we treat others in general, including animals and the elderly? I think that's, and love. Love between men and women and between friends, even between humans and animals. There was a question, blue shirt, yes. But the question is, do the bonobos write, and can they leave behind a legacy of writing for other bonobos? And I don't know. They're not doing it yet. I'm not a scientist, I'm a novelist. I can only speak to my own experience. I know that Pam Benicia will write lexigrams on the floor in chalk, but it's a temporary, but they do have an oral history. I know that their mother, the real matriarch at the trust, her name is Matata, and she was in the jungle for approximately eight years because she was wild caught, so they don't really know, but that they speak to each other. The bonobos have their own language, and it's an actual language. Kanzi uses stone napping, so they create stone tools, they create knives, and the way that they have persuaded him to do this is they give him a drum with M&Ms in the bottom and a tight skin over top, and if he successfully creates a knife, he can cut the skin and get the treats. Pam Benicia is not as good at stone napping as her brother, and so Kanzi, knowing this, hid his knife in the room. And after he left the room, and after Pam Benicia entered the room, he screeched out something to her, and she went immediately to the hiding place, got the knife, slid open her drum, and got the M&Ms. So we know that they are communicating information, it just is not taking the form of written words. Yes? The question was about where bonobos live in the wild, and approximately how many of them are left, and are there any efforts being made to preserve them? The answer is that they live in a very, very tiny segment of the world, which is one of the reasons that they went undiscovered until 1928. They live in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. And fortunately for them, they are very difficult to detect. They travel silently in the tree canopy, and so it's been difficult to establish solid numbers on how many are left, but the estimates are somewhere between 15,000 and 50,000, which does leave them critically endangered. The truly sad thing about this is that the only thing that is threatening the wild bonobo is humans. They are the victims of the bushmeat trade. What seems to happen is what typically happens is that they shoot the mother and take the baby and sell the baby on the black market as a pet. And baby bonobos do not survive. Officials have pulled baby bonobos out of duffel bags at the Paris airport. But yes, the good news is that there is, and the civil war, of course, is just, so there's, through actual intention and through just carelessness, humans are wiping out this great ape. But the good news is that there are some places now, and there is an effort being made. The Lolaya Bonobo Sanctuary in the Congo is the only bonobo sanctuary in the world, and they take all of these orphaned babies and they nurse them back to health, and they move them into older and older groups until eventually they can release them back into the forest, and that's the only hope for the wild bonobo. And the other good news is that there's another group called the Bonobo Conservation Initiative, and they're establishing a, not human-free, but a safe area of the forest for these bonobos to be returned to and to protect the bonobos that already exist in there. And of course, this is coupled with outreach to the people who live in that area, because, you know, as much as it sounds like cannibalism to me to eat a bonobo, their children are starving and it's a protein source. So yeah, it's not too late yet. Yes. I'm going to call this more of a comment than a question, but I'll try to paraphrase, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but apparently there was something on NPR recently about wild bonobos having learned to deconstruct the snares that are being laid out for them and doing it in backward order from the way in which they were constructed, and that there is evidence that the bonobos are transmitting this among themselves and also intergenerationally. No, I had not heard of this. I'm not surprised. Go bonobos. Oh, orange. Yes, sorry. The question is, will I be going back to visit them? And oh, yes, forever and always. And in fact, I'm not going to even wait till my next visit to send the new Mr. Potato Head, because, you know, she wants a potato head, she's getting a potato head. Is there anyone I'm missing from? Oh, yes. I'm sorry, there was an announcement going on. I'm going to paraphrase. You went to the Lolaya? Lucky. I'm not brave enough yet. Comment, I guess, was that the many of the people there, Claudine André, for example, there many of the people working at this sanctuary are Francophones, and whether the bonobos therefore understand some French, I'm going to assume yes. It's, you know, language. One of the astonishing things to come out of the studies at the Trust is that bonobos acquire language in the same way and in the same method as humans do, human infants do, which is to say through exposure and a desire to communicate. And there's a language window, just as there is with human infants, and if you miss it, it's missed, it's gone. Matata, the one who lived in the jungle until she was 8, never could grasp lexigrams. They tried for 2.5 years to teach her lexigrams, and I think she mastered a handful at best. And she had this infant who was making a nuisance of himself during the time that they were trying to teach her this, and hanging off her head and jumping on the board and generally making trouble. And they took Matata away to get pregnant away again. And after a day of looking for his mother, this baby realized that she wasn't hiding and she was not there to negotiate and barter for him anymore. And lo and behold, he had absorbed the entire lexigram board over the 2.5 years of just sort of listening in. And that's Kanzi. No, I don't think that there are any Francophone speakers at the... I mean, I don't know. I don't think that they're speaking French to them. But, you know, I think it's quite remarkable that these apes know essentially two human languages. They're speaking... They know, understand spoken English, and they are communicating back using lexigrams. And I also think it's remarkable that they have come our direction, but we have not yet managed to go theirs. Yes. The question is whether I ever was allowed inside I'm not going to call them cages at the Trust, the enclosure with the bonobos, and the answer is no. And I also that there's some chimp facility which also doesn't allow that because they're so much stronger and they're wild animals. I'm going to comment first of all by saying that you could not pay me enough to be in a room with an unrestrained chimp. Chimps can and do rip people's faces off, and they're very different from bonobos. But no, there are USDA laws. I was behind glass or I was behind mesh, except for when I was out in the forest and I was out there with scientists. I was not allowed physical contact with them, and in fact that's the reason that Pam Benicia was not allowed to hand me part of her apple. And Pam Benicia actually went into kind of I don't know if I want to call it a sulk, but she got very sad when we were out having our tea party. I was wearing shorts, and she noticed a bruise on my leg, and she was very interested in my hurt, because they don't have a lexicogram for bruise, and so she was asking me about my hurt, and how it had happened, and was it getting better? And I said, oh yes, it's just because I have a really big dog, and my 107-pound dog thinks she's a lap dog, and so I'm always covered in bruises. And then Pam Benicia wanted to come and groom me, because that's what bonobos do. And she wasn't allowed to, and she was so upset. She spread her lexicogram board out, because there's three pieces, it folds up. She spread it out, and she just lay across it, essentially covering all her words. I'm not talking for a while, I'm upset. Yes. Oh, okay, there were lots of parts to that. Let me, what was the first? Oh, the first part of it was, how did I create the relationship between, in Water for Elephants, between Jacob and Rosie, because it wasn't based on a real animal. During the course of my research and reading the historical texts about the circus, most of the really interesting stories involved elephants. And so I sort of boiled them all down into the elephant that is Rosie. And although she may not have been based on a real elephant, by the time I was finished writing the book, she was definitely real to me. And in fact, I missed her for a long time after I finished writing the book. So in fact, going to the film set was absolutely spectacular. And you know, it was. I never in a million years would have expected that it would be made into a movie. And you asked also about the cameo. And so the cameo, my whole family got cameos in the movie, and so we're part of various crowd seats. But then there's one scene where Rosie is raiding the produce stand at a greengrocer's, and Rob Pattinson runs through the crowd, elbowing people out of the way, and he elbows a woman out of the way, and he says, "Excuse me, ma'am, that's me." Was there a question here? I have not seen Signing Apes, and yes, of course, ASL is as much a complex language as any other language. I have not seen apes signing, because these apes do not sign. I have seen videos of apes that sign, and I have read transcriptions of conversations with apes that sign, but I have not personally met and witnessed it myself. Yes. The lexigrams, can I explain them? Yes, they're pictorial representations of words, and they don't necessarily look anything like the word that they're representing. For example, you already know how I know this one. The lexigram for tickle is a blue square with a white circle and white wavy line across the center. So they're very. Actually, the lexigram for Perrier actually just says Perrier in it. But otherwise, they don't. It's very complex. But they're symbols. They're square symbols that represent words. And the really astonishing thing about the lexigram board that the bonobos use is that they include tenses and subjects and objects. And this was. You know, I'm not expecting Kanzi to go out and start doing quantum physics anytime soon, but I was communicating with them on a level that is much, much greater than I ever thought. And I went in there knowing that they were going to communicate. I just did not expect quite the level and the memory and the manipulation of Diet Tuesdays and so on that I experienced. Yes. The question is whether I was happy with the way that the movie portrayed Water for Elephants and if there were any major changes. And the strange thing about movie sets, and of course I've never been on one before, but they don't film the scenes in order. And so I haven't seen any of the film yet. I've read the scripts, and so I had an idea of where we were in the process. I have every faith that it's going to be very true to the story. They had to make some changes, obviously, because they're taking a book that takes 12 to 14 hours to read and compressing it into something that can be viewed in 2 hours. But I was really literally blown away when I first laid eyes on the tents and saw the Benzini brothers and thought, wow, you know, 5 years ago this was all in my head. So. And it's still fake, because it's Hollywood, but, like, yeah. The question was, did I have any input into the script? And the answer is no. And if I had, they would have had to throw it out and start over anyway, because script writing is an entirely different skill and not one that I pretend to possess. I think that it's Richard Gravenese who did the script, and I did read it, and he did brilliant things with it. He combined a few scenes, and he combined a few characters, and these are not things that I would have come up with. So I didn't, because it would have been a terrible script. Yes. What inspiration led me to the writing of Water for Elephants? I actually was 2 weeks into another novel and had just returned from a research trip to Hawaii. Hard to explain to the IRS now. And I opened up the Sunday paper and found a vintage circus photograph. And I could feel my husband getting more and more worried in the background, because it was taken by a camera that could produce negatives that were insanely huge. I can't remember the exact dimensions anymore, but something like 20 by 24 inches, and that's the negatives. So they were able to, the negatives could capture enormous amount of detail on hundreds of people at once. You could see every rhinestone and every barrette, the wrinkles in the stockings, the feathers, the fronds on the feathers, and it just occurred to me at that moment that, of course, this was a situation that's a fiction writer's dream. I mean, anything can happen, and believably. So, as I said, my husband was getting more and more worried and starting to pace, and I finally just stabbed the paper. I said, I'm doing this next. And so I did. Yes. Oh, the question was whether I just spoke to them, I guess, as I'm speaking to you now, or whether I simplified, and and how they responded. I just spoke to them as I'm speaking to you now. I tried to follow along with my lexigram board, because that's one of the ways that you reinforce the connection between the words, but it's such a complicated board that I was lucky if I could find four or five words out of my own sentences ever. And so the apes understand many, many more words than they're capable of responding with, because they are limited by their vocabulary of 384 symbols, although they do make amazing combinations, like bread surprise. Kanzi's word for kale is slow lettuce, because it takes so long to chew. Yes. But the question was, because the apes in the book are signing, how authentic is the communication that is in the book? There are many transcriptions of conversations with apes in the scientific texts that have been collected over 40 years of language studies, and wherever possible, I used them verbatim. Yes. Oh, so I've fallen in love with elephants and apes, and what am I going to fall in love with next? I have an idea, and it's just rattling around, but until I'm off the road, I really can't get to it. And the other thing is that my writing process is so organic that even if I told you anything about it right now, it would not appear in the book when it finally comes out. So I'm just not going to say anything right now. Yes. Where can you go to see the apes? You cannot. You can't see the ones at the Trust. They're not an exhibit. They're not on display. They invite you in. If you're studying, or if you're studying, and if you go and do the work, and if the bonobos invite you in, then you can come in. But you can see there are various zoos that have bonobos. San Diego, Milwaukee. I can't remember. There's a couple of others, but there aren't very many bonobo exhibits at zoos, because of the amount of sexual activity makes families uncomfortable. Explaining to the children, a little difficult. So, I've just been given the two question. Yes. Yeah, you. I know it's hard. I need a laser pointer. Okay, how old was I when I knew I wanted to be a writer? I can't remember ever not wanting to be a writer. How old was I when I knew I could write? I don't know, I'm still figuring it out. And what was the third? Oh, my early influences. I read voraciously, and my second grade report card actually said, if books contain calories, Sarah would be obese. I always had a book open on my lap or in my desk, and I was just always, always reading. So I've never known a time that this wasn't what I wanted to do. Oh, random number generator, you. Well, it was for my book that I haven't finished. What was the research I was doing in Hawaii? It involved dolphins, and I don't know if I'll ever finish that book. I actually picked it up again and abandoned it again to write Ape House, so I don't know if it died on the vine or if it's still ripening. If I use it as a springboard book enough times, I suppose eventually I'll just finish it by default. But I don't know if I'll finish it. It was dolphins. And I think that's it. Thank you very, very much.
This podcast was presented by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation and made possible by your contributions to the Seattle Public Library Foundation. Thanks for listening.